Did you know we have completely ad-free early access to all of our episodes? Well, we do. Not only that, but we have dozens of bonus episodes waiting for you. Head on over to patreon.com/ghosttownpod, and you can check it out for 7 days absolutely free. That's patreon.com/ghosttownpod. Did you know we have completely ad-free early access to all of our episodes? Well, we do. Not only that, but we have dozens of bonus episodes waiting for you. Head on over to patreon.com/ghosttownpod, and you can check it out for 7 days absolutely free. That's patreon.com/ghosttownpod. Last Dance. I'm Jason Horton.
I'm Rebecca Lieb.
And this is Ghost Town.
Just 25 miles outside of the city is Douglasville, the notorious and complicated strip club capital of Philadelphia. Like many who commute there, Douglasville itself leads an illicit double life. By day, it exists as a quiet, oaken township on the shores of the historic Schuylkill River. But by night, the neon lights promise Philadelphians a debaucherous buffet of strong drinks, sexy dancers, and X-rated escapes. While Douglasville's dichotomies might be lost on those looking for a simple night of fun, insiders know to proceed with caution. An innocent dance can quickly turn deadly. Today on Ghost Town, the murder of dancer Rachel Ciani. On Saturday, April 1st, 2000, New Jersey State Police's 911 dispatch received a call from Richard Scott, an ATV rider who spotted a body underneath the New Jersey Turnpike Bridge. Detective John Villamil of the New Jersey State Police immediately headed to the scene. There he found a body lying face down. The victim was a Caucasian woman with brown hair, approximately 20 to 30 years old and 100 pounds. She wore a patterned sweater, blue jeans, a silver butterfly necklace, and white socks. At first glance, Villamil feels like this body appeared out of nowhere. There are no tire tracks or drag marks near the body, and the victim has no personal identification. Furthermore, the victim's white socks are pristine, a strange detail given that she's been found on an all-terrain vehicle path underneath a busy bridge. Detective Villamil then heads to the upper bridge deck, which tells a completely different story. There he notices pops of colored fabric on the path below, fibers from the victim's sweater lodged between the two concrete slabs, along with bloodstains spattered on the side of the retaining wall, almost directly above the body. No shoes are found anywhere. To Villamil, this suggests that the victim had been carried to the bridge and was violently thrown 112 feet to her death. As forensic technicians process the scene, they find a 10-inch indentation in the ground under the victim's body. In addition, they take DNA swabs from the bloodstains on the retaining wall. Though he's fairly certain that the victim has been thrown from the top of the bridge, Villamil and his partner still can't rule out suicide, until personnel from the New Jersey Medical Examiner's Office arrive. At the scene, they note that the victim has fallen and landed on her left side, but had also sustained injuries on her right side. They document bruising, likely caused by significant internal bleeding, and defensive wounds indicated that she fought back at some point. Now, Villamil knew for certain that he's looking at the scene of a violent, brutal murder. He'd made calls for any and all surveillance cameras that had footage of the bridge in the last couple days, hoping for, among the likely hundreds of hours of footage, he might find a lead. Unsurprisingly, the victim's lack of identification also poses a problem for the investigation, so Villamil has the station put a call out to media outlets in the surrounding New Jersey and Pennsylvania area, with a general physical description of the victim and her clothing, complete with silver butterfly necklace. As the information was dispersed, Villamil wondered who this young woman was and what exactly happened to her. Fortunately, he doesn't have to wait long for the first question to be answered. A former boyfriend recognizes the description that the police released, especially the butterfly necklace. The woman is 21-year-old Rachel Ciani, a student at Bucks County Community College. Villamil located Rachel's family, her father Richard, stepmother Janet, brothers Anthony and William, and stepbrothers Thomas and Charles. Richard tearfully explains that Rachel was shy but a loving woman, a psychology major with a deep interest in human behavior. Rachel lived at home with several family members to save money and was close to graduating. At that point, she had completed 57 of the 60 credits needed for her degree. When asked about her upbringing, Richard Ciani goes on to say that Rachel had a rough childhood. At 8, her parents got divorced, which devastated her. But even more traumatic was the sudden death of her mother 3 years later. Richard eventually remarried, and both Richard and Janet explained that they did their best they could to provide a happy home for Rachel. Richard tells Villamil that Rachel's peers might know more. Recently, Rachel had been taking her beat-up white Lincoln sedan out a lot, presumably to school and to socialize with friends. Setting off to Pennsylvania, Villamil immediately contacted Bucks County Police Department for access to their community college records. Like many cases before, the varied Pennsylvania State Police, County Police Departments, Philadelphia Police Department, and New Jersey Police Department frequently worked together, having a supportive and interreliant relationship. In fact, with New Jersey townships essentially functioning as suburbs of Philadelphia, more often than not, cases traverse the closely intertwined jurisdictions, making cooperation a crucial part of the investigative process. At the community college, Villamil questions Rachel's ex-boyfriend and her college friend, Kim Letario, who also had come forward to the New Jersey police. They say that Rachel was always incredibly sweet but painfully shy. The studious introvert hated attention. That is, until she enrolled in a college acting class for fun. The class was revolutionary for Rachel, they say, teaching her to step outside of herself into alternative personae, transforming her into whatever person or role that she wanted. Letario says that lately, Rachel was more social than she had ever seen her, and was happier than ever, also. At this point, Villamil wondered what went wrong in the college student's life. She had no known enemies, nobody who might want to hurt her. Villamil continued to question Rachel's friends and family while still pursuing the tips that trickled in from his call for public information. But one tip takes the investigation into an entirely new and shocking direction. A call comes in from a man named William Love, owner of a strip club named Divas International Gentlemen's Club in Douglasville, PA, just 3 miles from the crime scene. He tells police that he knows the woman found under the New Jersey Turnpike Bridge, and that he'd last seen her on Tuesday of that week. In fact, her car is still parked in his parking lot. Her name is Roxanne, Love says, and she is his best dancer. Villamil doesn't quite know how to take in this information. Is Love confused, or did Rachel Ciani really moonlight as an exotic dancer at a local strip club? Though it reads like a bizarre movie plot, after talking to Rachel's cousin, Nancy Finan, he knows Love's statement is accurate. Finan hesitantly tells Villamil that Rachel did have a secret. After years of struggling to pay her tuition, and after the success she'd had in acting class, Rachel answered an ad at Divas for Dancers. Soon, she was working at the strip club 3 to 5 times a week, earning as much as $400 a night. Now Villamil enlists the help of Bucks County investigator Victor Tunis, who accompanies him to Divas, a place that feels worlds away from Ciani's home or school environment. There, they find Rachel's car and search it. They find nothing of note inside, but have forensic technicians come to take fingerprints. Inside the club, Villamil then interviews Love. Love says his clients adored Foxy Roxy, as they called her, a shy introvert offstage who would come alive under the lights. Roxanne was a pro, but also like a sister to them, he said. When asked if there might be a customer who took her attention the wrong way, they agreed that this was definitely a possibility. Many men misread her commitment to the job as a sign that she wanted them sexually. Still, most clients were incredibly respectful and grateful for her attention. Soon, Rachel's autopsy report comes back, giving even more insight into her violent end. The report says Rachel's cause of death is blunt force trauma, proving beyond a doubt that Rachel fought for her life and was even still alive when she was thrown from the bridge. Other information also comes back about a DNA swab from the blood on the retaining wall and the fingerprints from Rachel's car. The blood on the wall is in fact Rachel's, and, unsurprisingly, the fingerprints in the car are also Rachel's. Unfortunately, no other fingerprints or DNA are found. Villamil and Tunis then asked the dancers themselves about Roxanne, specifically if any clientele had posed a threat to her safety. But a client isn't the person that comes into their minds. It's a former employee. His name is Jason Woods, and he used to work as a cook in the Divas kitchen. Rachel's coworkers say that the 26-year-old was obsessed with her, that he had started harassing Rachel outside of the club and was eventually fired for his increasingly inappropriate conduct towards her. Villamil and Tunis track down Woods, who is now their prime suspect. Meanwhile, the media is eating up every detail of the investigation, with sensational student dancer and slain stripper headlines splayed across every local paper. Divas International Gentlemen's Club also faces extensive scrutiny and coverage, which leads Villamil and Tunis to their next big break in the case. But for now, let's take a break. After learning that Rachel Siani did in fact work at Divas, a local Douglasville police officer comes forward with a tip of his own. He tells Villamil and Tunis that he responded to a disturbance call at Divas Gentlemen's Club around 2 a.m. the previous Tuesday, the same day Rachel was last seen there. He tells Villamil that he was in his patrol car and witnessed a man with two women. One woman, who was smoking in the parking lot, fit Rachel's description. The police officer describes the man he had seen, middle-aged, Caucasian, heavy-set, with blue eyes and a beard. Armed with that description, Villamil is more and more confident that Woods is his man. Villamil soon finds Jason Woods and brings him in for questioning. Despite looking nothing like the Douglasville officer's description, Woods has a solid alibi that checks out. Dismayed, detectives Villamil and Tunis head back to the club, armed with a description of the man the officer had seen and the woman who was talking to Rachel in the parking lot. Eventually, they connect with Michelle Bupp, the other dancer who was in the parking lot that Tuesday morning. Bupp said she had in fact been outside Divas with Rachel after Rachel had gone to a nearby bar named Sportsters. She identifies the man that was with them as John Denofa, but that she left after Rachel offered to walk the drunk Denofa to the Akana Lodge, a common occurrence between Denofa and Siani. The well-to-do businessman was a Divas regular, often staying until closing and then sleeping it off at the adjoining Econo Lodge motel. While Love says Denofa is easygoing and generous with the dancers, Bupp and the other dancers say he was harmless but a bit creepy, that they tolerated his weird antics because he was such a big tipper. Bupp, Simonton, Boker, and the others all told Villamil that Roxanne was unequivocally Denofa's favorite and that he spent most of his money on her. When Villamil asks Love what Denofa's personal life is like, he tells the detective about John's wife, Lisa Denofa. He says that she is accepting of her husband's behavior. In fact, one morning after a long night at Divas and the Econo Lodge, Love explains, Lisa even met her husband and one of the dancers for breakfast the next day. Villamil and Tunis then go to Denofa's house in Buckingham, Pennsylvania, and question Lisa Denofa. Despite the information they've just heard from Love, the Denofas appear to be respectable community members. Lisa says John makes a good living as the owner of Apex Sign Supplies, a wholesale business in Warminster, Pennsylvania. He also serves as the chairman of his high school alumni association. When Villamil asks Lisa if she's aware of John's visits to Divas, she confirms what Love has told him. After his DUI in 1998, she tells Villamil she often drops him off at Divas so he won't drink and drive his red pickup truck drunk, and knows he spends some nights at the Econo Lodge. It's about fun, but it's also about safety, she says. Soon after talking to Lisa Denofa, John himself comes in for questioning. He says that he did see Rachel in the early morning hours on March 29th, but that she never came into his hotel room. Villamil and Tunis sense that the man is lying, but they still don't have enough evidence to arrest Denofa, so they head to a location that might give them a bit more information, the Econo Lodge Hotel. There, Villamil shares descriptions and information about Rachel and Denofa, hoping someone will recognize them. And luckily, front desk night clerk Diane Crouch does. She tells Villamil that she did see Denofa, who was a guest that night at room 223, and a petite brunette headed into his room around 2:30 a.m. on Wednesday morning. Villamil and his forensics team enter and search room 223, and what they find is a small blood stain in the shower. They also find blood on the sidewalk outside of the hotel room's window. Less than an hour later, Villamil finally gets a hit on the many hours of surveillance footage he's had PD pull in and around the New Jersey Turnpike Bridge. The cameras show John DeNofa's red pickup truck heading through the Turnpike Bridge toll booth towards New Jersey before dawn on Wednesday morning. Sprawled in the flatbed of his truck is what looks like the body of a woman in jeans and a patterned sweater. The surveillance also shows the truck headed the opposite direction, with nothing in its flatbed. Tunis issues a search warrant for DeNofa's truck, and he and Villamil find it at DeNofa's home. Once the search begins, they quickly discover the vehicle has been scrubbed clean, and if there had once been traces of blood, they were no longer to be found. Luckily for the investigators, a major oversight seals DeNofa's fate. The businessman failed to clean underneath the plastic bedliner of his flatbed. While the DNA in and around the hotel, the bloodstains at the hotel, proved to be too scant to test, blood in DeNofa's truck is a match to Rachel Ciani. On April 7th, John DeNofa is arrested at his Pennsylvania home and taken to Bucks County Jail to await trial. At his trial, Bucks County Assistant District Attorney David Zelis establishes what he believed happened on the last night of Rachel Ciani's life. On March 31st, Rachel finished her shift at the club, changed clothes, and headed to a bar named Sportsters. DeNofa followed her there and then followed her back to Diva's, where she had a smoke with Michelle Bupp. Eventually, Rachel escorted DeNofa to the Econo Lodge, where he checked in for the night. There, Rachel refused his advances. In a fit of rage, he threw her from his motel window. But when he discovered the fall hadn't killed her, he needed to finish the job. In the early hours of April 1st, DeNofa drove the critically injured college student over the turnpike and threw her from the bridge. Though always maintaining his innocence, in November 2002, John DeNofa is found guilty by a Bucks County jury of first-degree murder and is sentenced to 30 years to life in prison.